Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of its most important fronts at the moment, that war for the free world, that is Europe. And within Europe, one of the places where the battle lines are being drawn increasingly violently is Sweden. And when it comes to matters involving Sweden, we, of course, turn religiously to Ingrid Carlqvist, an author and investigative journalist based there who is renowned for her courage in speaking truth to power, specifically about Sharia supremacism and the fact that it is increasingly a blight on her country and indeed a threat to its people. Ingrid, it is so good to have you back. Welcome. It's been too long.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I want to talk with you about what's going on in Sweden, but I thought it might be interesting to our audience to just note that we're having this conversation with you about some very troubling developments there on the day that, by some estimates, or claims anyway, 50,000, I think predominantly Sharia supremacist Muslims, will be descending upon the Minnesota Vikings Stadium in Minneapolis, St. Paul for 2 days of celebration of a holiday they call Eid al-Adha, which is the day where they celebrate the slaughter of animals and the commemorate an event in Islamic history. It is, I'm afraid, indication of how things are heading in our own country that prompts me to ask, how's it going in yours, where such folks are, it seems, now increasingly on the march?
Yeah, I mean, we have, you know, all our politicians, they always go out with congratulations to the Muslims. I mean, they rarely say Happy Christmas, Merry Christmas, or something like that. But every time it's Ramadan or Eid, they go out, Happy Eid, Happy Ramadan to all the Muslims in Sweden, or the Swedish Muslims. So the politicians, they're on their knees, I should say. But, you know, now we have some problems in Sweden. You know, there's an upcoming election in September 9, and the polls are very, you know, they almost all of the polls say that the Sweden Democrats, you know, the party who does not want any more immigration to Sweden, they seem to become the largest party. And the Social Democrats, who have been running Sweden for decades, you know, with some few breaks, I think they will do their worst election since we had the vote in 1928.
And this is against the backdrop of some things that are going on in the streets of some of Sweden's most important cities. Tell us what's happening and how that is feeding into this sentiment about, well, immigrants, many of them from Muslim Sharia supremacist lands.
Yeah, there is this new sport in Sweden, burning cars. We have, I mean, every year the amount of cars being set on fire is doubled. And we also have a large arsons on schools. Nobody talks about that. But, I mean, so many schools are being burned down every year. But the car burning, that's a sport. And it's always in these so-called areas, you know, We might call them ghetto, but we don't in Sweden because we are politically correct, you know. But let's call them ghetto. And so last week, there were like 100 cars being set on fire in Gothenburg and in some other cities, almost simultaneously. And that's what got our prime minister to say, First he said, it's like they are military operations. And you said, yeah, why not? Could be something like that. But then he said to the arsonist, what the hell are you doing?
And what they're doing, it seems, and we should be clear, Ingrid Carlquist, as to who is engaging in this sport. Is this your average Swede that is torching cars?
We actually found out yesterday that the court are refusing to name the three people who are in custody right now. But the alternative media is very good in Sweden, as you know. So we found out from one of these alternative media sites that they are called Dahoud Kavak, Alan Hussein, and Mohammed Abdishakur. And those are not Swedish names, if you wonder.
Yeah, no. Let me just ask you, to the extent that these sorts of activities are now increasingly commonplace, it evidently is feeding into this rising tide behind the Sweden Democrats about the idea of bringing in more of these, Sharia supremacists, I think it's fair to say. What about the ones that are there already?
Yeah, we have a new party, which I think might be in the parliament September 9. It's called Alternative for Sweden. They got the name from the German party, but they are not sister parties in any way. But they are very, very clear. First, we must stop all immigration, not one asylum seeker more. Then we start repatriating people. We begin with the criminals, the ones who are not supposed to be here, the beggars, and so on. And that's about 500,000 people.
So this would, at the very minimum, seem as though you're going to have in Parliament people who want to stop appeasing these jihadists, for want of a better term. It seems that's what's going on in the streets of your cities now. To the extent that they are going to, the people of Sweden, repudiate the Social Democrats and set the course for a different direction for your country, it seems to me this is a very promising thing for Sweden and presumably would be an important model for countries elsewhere in Europe that are facing similar kinds of problems, if not quite as obvious as car torching and school burnings.
Yeah, I sincerely hope so, because, you know, Swedes are very docile and we don't fight with each other very much and we just seem to go on with our lives. But now Swedes are mad, I tell you. I meet people every day. They are absolutely mad, and they want to stop this madness. They want to kick the old politicians out of the parliament and bring in new ones.
Well, we will look forward to your continuing reports on how that's coming. In the meantime, I just wanted to tell you and our audience, Ingrid Carlquist, that we're putting out today, as we speak, it is in the future, as we are heard, it will have happened, a new paper by a wonderful colleague of ours, Trevor Loudon, entitled Red Minnesota, How a State's Communist Roots Produce the Hard Left Politics That Are Enabling Its Burgeoning Sharia Supremacism. All of this keyed to explaining, giving context to this Super Eid Festival, I guess it's being called, in Minneapolis as we speak. Thank you so much, Ingrid Carlquist, for your faithfulness in telling the truth. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say Brad Johnson is in the house, virtually at least. He is a career Central Intelligence Agency operator in the clandestine services. He has, over the course of a very distinguished career of espionage on behalf of the United States, been the chief of station in several nations, meaning the senior-most intelligence officer in those countries. He is also, these days, the president of Americans for Intelligence Reform and a go-to guy for this program and, I think, for many others interested in understanding the ground truth about what's happening in the security services of our country, particularly on the intelligence side. Brad Johnson, it is so good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
The pleasure is mine. Let me ask you to talk a little bit about John Brennan. You, of course, have known him, I know, in the course of your time together in the agency. He's much in the news. This is not terribly surprising, in part given his conduct and in part given President Trump's response to that conduct, specifically the revoking of his clearances. Talk a little bit about the man and whether he should have gotten clearances in the first place.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. I would say there's two aspects to that. One, should he have gotten a clearance? And two, should he have ever been considered for director of the Central Intelligence Agency? And personally, I just don't see how he qualified for either one of those. Certainly, traditionally, somebody who I know it's been talked about quite a little bit, and including on your program, but he, of course, admitted to having been a communist and voted for the Communist Party and in earlier presidential elections here in the United States.
Well, just correction. I'm not sure he's admitted to being a communist. I think he certainly said he had voted for Gus Hall, for heaven's sakes, a Stalinist who was a presidential candidate repeatedly for the Communist Party of the United States.
Yeah, I guess you could draw a distinction there. I'm not sure there truly is one. If you're voting communist, I think that makes you communist.
Yeah, well, works for me, but just for the record.
Okay, very good. So certainly that would have disqualified traditionally anyone from being given a clearance. That was a line of questioning that traditionally was always done in the security clearance process.
And apparently he was nervous about being asked about it, but it didn't come up, interestingly enough, which seems extraordinary.
Yeah, all of those things have essentially been eliminated, as I believe you've covered previously. Nowadays, in the U.S. government, it's made famous by the FBI, but it is government-wide. You're not supposed to even say things like terrorists and, you know, radical terrorists and those sorts of things. And in the FBI training on terrorism, they don't use the word terrorism.
Well, heaven forfend that anyone mention Sharia supremacism or, you know, radical Islam or that sort of thing either. There was also this question, and it came up yesterday in my conversation with Andrew Bostom, which was really required listening. Andy Bostom mentioned that John Brennan's master's thesis, which he wrote before joining the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst, was redolent of a sympathy for authoritarianism and even for, well, Sharia supremacism, I think it's fair to say, that is very worrying as well. And again, the question is, how could a guy with these views have gotten cleared? And I guess the question to you, Brad Johnson, is, was this a one-off mistake? Or in your time in government, did you see people who probably shouldn't have had clearances either?
Yeah, no, it's definitely moving that way. I mean, it's been heavily politicized over in the, say, last couple of decades. But this was culminated, in fact, during the Obama years, where it has just been fine-tuned as a political weapon. But for a very long time, for the last couple of decades at least, it has been used so that essentially what they're doing is weeding out conservatives and turning a blind eye to anything, any of the liberal causes. So if you go back and look at security, I mean, that's the way it's been used very effectively to make sure that conservatives find it very, very difficult to move up. And again, this is USG-wide. You see it in NSA, FBI, CIA.
The whole alphabet soup. Well, let me come back to Brennan, because I did want to ask you one other question. I understand that one of the other features of his interesting career is that perhaps while he was station chief in Saudi Arabia, he actually converted to Islam. Do you know whether that's true or not, Brad?
Well, I personally, for a fact, don't know. He's never said that in front of me or anything like that. However, a very close friend of mine, also in the agency that I've known for nearly four decades, was in that area at the time of Brennan's conversion and has told me many times that he has seen personally that to be true and was personally aware of the details of it. So I'm fully convinced that he did indeed convert to Islam. Again, it's secondhand knowledge, but knowledge that I understand to be true.
Yeah. And again, that's not necessarily a problem. But when you combine it with some of the things that he has said about Islam or about Sharia or about the practice of the faith, about jihad, it really starts to raise questions about the man's judgment, or at least his truthfulness. And it raises a specific question. You alluded to the fact that the FBI can't have in its lexicon things that might give offense to Muslims. They can't train people to understand the actual threats that we're facing. It can't use training materials that would help clarify the threat, particularly from Sharia supremacism, Brad Johnson. This is something that was greatly exacerbated while John Brennan was the Homeland Security Advisor to President Obama, as I understand it. He essentially embraced the Muslim Brotherhood's demands that all of those things happen, not just in the FBI, but government-wide. And also, by the way, bringing in Muslim Brotherhood operatives as people, or affiliates anyway, as people from whom to take advice in the U.S. government. Another reason for being very concerned about the advisability of having clearances, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's stunning that people can get through clearance process with that background. But like I said, it's become a political tool now. And not only a political tool to weed out who gets clearances and to stop people from different that have different perspectives, essentially the conservative perspective, to stop them from getting it, but it's also used now as an organ of control. And for all of those people who already do have clearances, it's used to weed them out as if anything comes up they don't like, not based on factual security issues. And there is no recourse. They have absolute power and control now. So if you've got a clearance, you belong to security. And security is a political tool of the left.
I wanted to come back to, you know, something you mentioned a moment ago about the inadvisability or the lack of qualifications of John Brennan to be the director of Central Intelligence. This was something that was done by Barack Obama, the entrusting of that important position to a man who was clearly a political operative through and through. What kinds of things, Brad Johnson, from your time inside the agency, did you see him doing as director that were problematic and, again, speak to the wisdom of revoking his clearances now, for sure, if not long before?
Well, what he would consider his crowning achievement and what I consider the low point are essentially he eliminated human intelligence, that is to say, human espionage, recruiting spies. He eliminated that from the CIA, which is just stunning. It's tantamount to taking ships out of the Navy and aircraft out of the Air Force. And it's the reason for having a CIA. And what he did is he called this a modernization, and he implemented this program. And in that modernization, they did turn towards cyber warfare, which is important. I'm not belittling that aspect of it. But what he did is he used these cyber built up cyber capabilities to eliminate Humint, which, by the way, Humint is also what drives a lot of cyber. You know, it's not just knowing what website to you know, how to find the websites to look at. It's not just having the capability to do something once you find it. And it's human that lets you know the people, the websites, the phone numbers, all of that stuff. That's how you feed that other system. And there is no replacement for human. I mean, it's even mentioned in the Bible. It goes all the way back. And there is no replacement for it. And it's tremendous blind spot now for us. And we've seen our human programs get wiped out, like in China that we've saw a few years back and so on. And those take decades to build. And now our pipeline of people that are capable of running those things is completely empty. The cadre of people that are capable of doing it are all getting old and dying and retiring and so on. So that capability is almost completely gone and is now going to be very difficult to rebuild. So it's just a stunning thing.
And we are further compounding the problem, as I understand it, by essentially contracting out to so-called liaison relationships with host government intelligence services for intelligence that they might share with us. And in your experience, Brad Johnson, what was the reliability of those host government services? Could we, in fact, depend upon them?
That traditionally has been called our liaison services, and now it's called our partnership countries. And you've seen that phraseology make its way into every level of government, and even the talking heads on news and so on are calling these our partner countries and so on. Now, liaison relationships, even with countries that we're close to, like the Brits and Canada and so on, are never perfect. There's always problems. So it's always a sliding scale. There are a few countries where we tend to have pretty good relationships, where it's overall a net positive and good. And then you have the other countries where the reliability of the information is shoddy at best. I mean, I would probably worldwide on the average, you can figure of everything they give you, 1 in 100 is good. And the rest of the time, it's, you know, you go to them and say, hey, we need somebody to report on XYZ over here. And they go, yeah, sure. Here's my brother-in-law. Of course, I'm not going to tell you it's my brother-in-law. Now you start paying him, I'll feed him information. And, you know, I'm going to get money into my family. I mean, they're running scams constantly.
Money into the family and disinformation perhaps into our system. Chilling stuff. Brad Johnson, there's so much more to talk with you about. We're going to have to leave it at that for the moment, though, but we'll talk with you more about all of this, my friend. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's good to have with us Gordon Chang, a man we have the privilege of visiting with just about every week. With his expertise on matters involving Asia and U.S. interests there, he is truly an invaluable resource to this program and to Fox News and The Daily Beast and other places where he appears frequently. We're always grateful to him for his time, as well as his writings, notably his two superb books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome. It's good to have you again.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I wanted to start with an important piece that you had in the National Interest recently, Gordon, about Taiwan. And you've made a rather bold policy recommendation with respect to the democratic nation that I tend to think of as it's been called, the Republic of China. Give us a flavor of what you're recommending and why it's so important at this moment.
I'm recommending that the United States make a public declaration that the U.S. will defend Taiwan against a Chinese attack. And the reason is there are a number of voices who feel that the United States should make it clear that we won't defend Taiwan. And what I do is I make two points from history. One of them is that in 1950, the United States drew a defense perimeter and did not include South Korea. That encouraged Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea, to go to Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin and say that the U.S. would not resist an attack on the South. And essentially what happened is they got the green light from Moscow and Beijing. Kim Il-sung attacked in June 1950. And despite what everyone thought, we did defend South Korea.
At horrific cost.
At horrific cost, 36,000 Americans. So the Korean War is not only the forgotten war, it's an unnecessary one. The other point I make is that if we go to the time when Saddam Hussein was threatening Kuwait, on the instructions of James Baker, who was then Secretary of State, April Glaspie, our ambassador to Baghdad, told Saddam Hussein in response to a question that we were not interested in intra-Arab disputes. And also, Kuwait was not a matter of concern to the United States. Well, within about 8 days, Hussein attacked Kuwait. And despite what we told him, we then went and defended Kuwait. And so that whole series of wars in the Middle East, again, unnecessary. I don't want the same thing to happen to Taiwan.
And there's a lot of reason to believe that the Chinese are, quite apart from whatever they think our policy is, preparing to forcibly seize Taiwan, is it not? So you're not talking about this as some sort of abstract issue. This is a very real potential threat, at least on a par with whatever Saddam Hussein was doing at the time of his invasion of Kuwait. I remember it well. And of course, what might have gone down in North Korea once it was unleashed. So it really is a public policy issue of the first order. Gordon, what do you say to those who were concerned that we'll be embroiling ourselves in a conflict with China, for which we are not very well prepared, for one thing, but over a country that is not directly and vitally connected to our interests?
Well, I believe Taiwan is directly and vitally connected to our interests. For about a century and a half, we have drawn our Western defense perimeter not off the coast of Hawaii, and basically not even off the coast of Guam, but off the coast of Asia. And that's where we defend the United States. Now, we could choose to defend it closer to home, but that would put Americans at risk. But there's something even more important. Right now, you've got China, which is territorially expansive. We've got to stop it someplace. But also, right now, China is attacking our democracy every day. And we cannot allow it to absorb a democracy through invasion. That would have terrible consequences, not only in Asia, but also in Europe as well. So this is where we have got to defend not just Taiwan, but our way of life, because we will have to defend ourselves. We saw the same dynamic in the 1930s in Europe, and we just do not want to repeat it in this century when our weapons are so much more destructive. So Taiwan defense, it's important because it's defending America.
Yeah, I think this is a critical point. And the idea of defending ourselves on other people's territory is one that I've always found very compelling. Gordon, when you talk about war, as we've discussed on many occasions, and I think it's now increasingly understood, even on a bipartisan basis in official Washington, China has been at war with this country for decades now, most of it couched in economic warfare, but of other kinds as well, including subversive campaigns and influence operations and espionage and technology theft and on and on. To the extent that this is a potential flashpoint for moving that thing over from a non-kinetic form of warfare, shall we say, to one that could well involve the old-fashioned kind of military conflict, do you think it imperative that we begin seriously enhancing the capability of not only our own forces in the Pacific, but also those of Taiwan?
Well, certainly, because right now in Asia, the balance of power favors the Chinese. And our Navy doesn't have critical capabilities, such as defending against swarms of hypersonic and other projectiles launched at our ships. And so at this particular time, in the Navy, in terms of cruise missiles and such, is really behind the Chinese. And this is important because, we talk of the war as non-kinetic now. But we know that from reporting in May of this year that the Chinese shined lasers. They injured two American pilots near Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. That's certainly an attack on an American plane, an attempt to bring it down. There have been these laser attacks not only in Africa, but also in the South China Sea and East China Sea. We know from March of 2009, the harassment of the Impeccable. Actually, the harassment was so severe that it did constitute an attack on an American vessel and therefore an act of war. We have seen all sorts of the taking of the Navy drone in December 2016 from international water. A number of acts of war against the United States. We have not responded to that. And so the Chinese think that they can continue with this type of dangerous conduct.
Yeah. And this is how miscalculations get started that can precipitate really horrific consequences. So I'm with you on the necessity of clarity about our policy line. And it does seem to me it's best drawn in the Taiwan Strait rather than to the exclusion of Taiwan. Gordon, on the economic warfare front, I did want to get a quick stock-taking from you as to where you think we stand with respect to these negotiations that have been taking place here in Washington this week. Is there a breakthrough imminent in your view, or is that unlikely?
It's unlikely that there's going to be a breakthrough. I think it's even unlikely that we're going to see even a deal of some sort. Even if there were a deal, It's not sustainable. Right now, there are two sides which are irreconcilable. The United States wants China to comply with its trade obligations, and China absolutely refuses to do so because its subsidies, its industrial program, its forced taking of intellectual property, its theft of intellectual property are core to the economic system that the Communist Party runs. And it believes that those means are necessary to keep the Chinese economy going. So this is going to be a long-term struggle, and it's a struggle for the future. We've got to make sure that we have an economy that can commercialize the product of innovation. The Chinese don't want us to do that through very predatory means. So we have no choice but to defend ourselves, and I think it's really important. Whatever one thinks of the president right now is on a course of action which I think is absolutely critical to the future of the United States. We need to win what people call a trade war. I think it's actually different than that, because what the president is doing is trying to prevent the Chinese from stealing U.S. intellectual property. That's what these Section 301 tariffs are all about. We need to support the president.
Yeah. I think what we're in is clearly, at the very minimum, a cold war with China. And you're absolutely right, again, that we have to prevail in it. Gordon, let me turn to one other topic. You've written in the Epoch Times about China's abuse of its Muslim population. We hear a lot about the Uyghurs, not so much about the Way. Talk about both, if you would.
In Weizhou, which is in the Ningxia Autonomous Region, another group of Muslims, the Way, are defending the Grand Mosque, which was built over the last 2 years. The Chinese want to tear it down. The Han Chinese, the ethnic majority, is trying to eradicate Islam. And this is especially interesting because the Way have been completely assimilated into Chinese society and were peaceful. In Xinjiang, which is the northwestern part of China, you have the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs also were a peaceful people until horrific repression radicalized some portion of the population. Now you have essentially a crime against humanity where about a million or maybe even more of Uyghurs have been detained in internment camps for no reason other than their religion in most cases. The world needs to speak out because this is perhaps the most horrific human rights abuse in the world today.
Mm. Well, there's a lot of competition for that dubious distinction, I'm sorry to say, but this is a blight for sure on humanity, and it's being done by the Chinese, even as they are persecuting Christians and other minorities as well. All reason for us to be clear-eyed about them. You are first and foremost in that department as far as I'm concerned. Gordon Chang, it's always a privilege to talk with you. I look forward to doing so again next week. Thank you for joining us today. Next up, we'll speak with Ambassador Yoram Edinger about developments with Iran and Turkey and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's always a pleasure to have with us one of the smartest men I know about matters involving the Middle East and not only the interests of his own country, Israel, but also those of the United States in that very, well, dynamic at best and volatile at worst region of the world. He is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He has served his country as a counselor with the rank of ambassador in the United States, specializing in congressional relations, a subject on which he is deeply expert. He has been the author of the Edinger Report and is an extraordinarily thoughtful and, well, perspicacious observer of the scene, as well as an influential figure in how we all think about it. Welcome back, Mr. Ambassador. It's so good to have you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your show.
It's my pleasure. Well, let me begin by asking you for a sort of assessment of where things stand at the moment with respect to Iran. We've been hearing a lot about the increasing opposition of the Iranian people to their government. Your ambassador Benjamin Netanyahu has been actively feeding that, it seems, with, among other things, a very interesting water initiative. I know our national security advisor to the president, John Bolton, has been in Israel consulting about Iran and much else, I'm sure. But give us your sense, Mr. Ambassador, of what's the state of play there and the future prospects.
Well, there are a few things which concern me with regard to Iran. The first one is that so far we have been exposed to the proper talk coming out of Washington. There has been, no doubt, a substantial walk as well as far as sanctions. But the major question is, will there be a sufficient, adequate walk to put an end to the regime of the Ayatollahs, which is the core of the problem, and this is not limited to Iran. It has to do with the Iranian machete at the throat of every one of the pro-U.S. Arab countries in the Persian Gulf, in the Arabian Peninsula, and the Ayatollah's megalomaniacal vision, which has to do with Africa and Asia and even Central and South America. The other thing which concerns me a lot is the focus on nuclear capabilities by the Ayatollahs, which somehow does, I would say, shift attention away from the very, very clear and present and lethal danger, and this is conventional Ayatollahs. Conventionally, they are now threatening every single pro-American Arab regime, and I hope that the preoccupation with the long-term nuclear problem is not going to haunt us when it comes to the very immediate term conventional Ayatollah threat to stability in the Middle East and beyond.
Well, I noticed that you were speaking both of a machete to the throat of America's Arab allies and the danger posed by the conventional forces to those allies. Obviously, Iran poses a threat to your own country as well, Mr. Ambassador, and while you may be better equipped to deal with that threat than the others, I'm sure that it has become increasingly a matter of concern to not only security-minded individuals in Israel like yourself, and I think all of them are generally pretty security-minded because the threats are so imminent, but that it's become evident that what Iran is now doing in Syria is posing an intensifying danger to, well, your interests and security as well as the region more generally as well. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, there's no doubt that the Ayatollahs constitute a threat to Israel as they do to every other tenant in the Middle East. But that, again, should not shift or drive our attention away from their order of priorities. The number one priority, geostrategic priority of the Ayatollahs has never been Israel. They want Israel out of the way, but Israel is not their number one goal. The number one goal is to dominate the Persian Gulf. The number two goal is to expand it and dominate the Arabian Peninsula and the Indian Ocean. In order to achieve those two immediate goals, they have to deal with a much more awesome hurdle than the Israeli hurdle, and that's the United States. And they're trying to achieve that through attrition. They're trying to achieve that by hoax type of policies, but let's not ignore their order of priorities. When it comes to Israel, obviously we do our utmost to push them away from our boundaries as far as possible. That's why we are very much engaged with what's going on in Syria, where there is a growing Iranian presence. However, I have no doubt that the Iranians, the Ayatollahs, are aware that should they commit some action against Israel, they risk a very, very painful Israeli retribution, which may not be limited to what conventionally may be expected. And it seems to me that they're not going to risk their immediate, their long-term goals on the altar of their goals vis-a-vis Israel. And in that respect, it seems to me that the U.S.-Israel strategic cooperation is another example which highlights U.S. and Israel as a unique alliance facing very compatible challenges. We both understand the Ayatollah's threat, which unfortunately the vast majority of Europe still does not get.
As we see them trying aggressively to flout U.S. sanctions and to prop up the Iranian regime. We're almost out of time. I did want to ask you about one other country in the region that is increasingly aggressively supporting Iran and hostile to not only Israel, but to the United States as well. And that is America's nominal NATO ally, Turkey. Give me your read on what Recep Tayyip Erdogan is up to at the moment and what it means not just for your region, but for us as well.
Erdogan is driven by very, very substantial, dramatic Islamic vision. He views himself as the worthy leader of the Muslim world. He follows fundamental Islamic school of thought.
Yeah, I call it Sharia supremacism.
Absolutely. And as such, once again, he considers the U.S. to be the number one Satan. Israel, just like the Iranians, Israel is considered small, the number two Satan. The interesting thing about Erdogan is that while he is enmeshed with his megalomaniacal Islamic vision, he also has recognized the very unique qualities of Israel, and as vicious as he has been towards Jews in general and the Jewish state in particular, the trade balance between Turkey and Israel has expanded in recent years in a very substantial manner. Back in 2005, it was around $2.5 billion. Today, it's about between $5 and $6 billion. Obviously, we do not deal with national security elements, but when it comes to commercial aspects, when it comes to medical, pharmaceutical, agricultural, irrigation, communications, Erdogan has recognized the qualities of Israel, and this has been reflected in our trade balance with Turkey.
Well, I've always been concerned about doing deals that enable your enemies to be more prosperous or at least better able to contend with some of their domestic difficulties. I think that can have a strategic impact as well, of course. Mr. Messer, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope we'll be able to visit with you again soon. In the meantime, thank you for your time today and come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.